Cooper Talk. Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. I got to tell you something, people. You know I love the 80s, you know, seeing that I was in high school in the 80s and in college, and there's certain songs that remind me of the 80s, and Red Red Wine is one of them by UB40, and it was my sophomore year in college when that came out at the beautiful Stockton State down there in Pomona, New Jersey, and it played everywhere, bars, parties, and it was just a song that we would dance to, and it sort of became a drinking anthem, even though none of us drank Red Red Wine. We were in college. We drank cheap beer. We drank grain alcohol punch. But it's one of those songs that when I walk through anywhere I hear it, it takes me back, and I'm so happy to have one of the men who is responsible for that beautiful hit from UB40, Robin Campbell. How you doing, Robin?
Hi, Steve. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Oh, yeah, there you go.
A little glass of red wine there for you.
Exactly. I'm drinking water right now. I was going to drink a stout, but I said, it's 4:30. I said, you know, I'll wait a little. I'll eat dinner. But I want to talk to you about, you have a tour coming up. And it's exciting. You're playing some festivals before you come to America. Now, tell me what it's like playing festivals, because you probably played so many in your career, but are they still have that charge and the excitement?
Yeah, it's not the same as playing, your own crowd, just because our fan base is so faithful and loyal and loud, you know, so. It's always great to play your own audience, but we're lucky. I mean, we have a backlog of hit records, you know, that people recognise, whatever generation they're from. So it's always great fun playing festivals. You know, we love playing gigs anyway. That's what we do and have done for a long time. So we like playing festivals. It's kind of like an easy gig, you know. But I just love doing them.
Well, you know what's fascinating? You know, you do have a backlog of records. You have over 20 albums. And, you know, when you think about that, you know, when you think of bands that have over 20 albums, there's not a lot. I mean, I'm a huge Springsteen fan growing up in New Jersey. I don't know if he has 20 yet, but you have 20. Oh, I think it's 21 or 22.
I really don't know. But, I thought it was more than that.
Well, it's funny. So how do you keep the artistry going? Because, you know, I mean, it's been over 40. I mean, UB45 came out last year, and it's like anything. Sometimes we feel like we lose a creative spark or things, but how do you keep it going with your composing and songwriting?
We've never struggled with that, really. It's always been a part of what we do, you know. It's a cyclical thing. You're in the studio. We've had our own studio for 40 years, so you know, whenever we're home, we're in the studio, and as soon as we finish an album, we're back out on the road, you know. Even while we're recording the album, we tend to be doing tours and festivals, etc. But I mean, you finish in the studio, you have the album, and you want to get out and play it to the fans, you know. And then as soon as you've spent a year touring around, playing it to the fans, getting there stamp of approval, you know, you're full of ideas again, and you get back home and you start on the new one, you know, the next album. And that's a cycle that we've been doing for 40 odd years, you know. It's we don't struggle at it. And also, of course, because now we have new members in the band, we have young members in the band full of life and enthusiasm. So even if we were a little jaded, you know, it's great having young musicians that are full of ideas and full of life, you know, kind of reinvigorates us. And we have Matt Doyle, who's our lead vocalist, has been with us now for, I think he's in his fourth year now. And he's full of ideas. He comes with songs, you know, all the time. I've got a new song, I've got a new idea. We have a keyboard player who's been with us for a couple of years now, Jared Gordon from Jamaica, who's, again, a very talented lad, full of ideas, you know, and he's now coming with songs that he's written. So, you know, it just keeps us going and keeps us fired up. It renews the juices, so to speak.
So now, how did Matt come to become the be in the band? And did you want to recruit younger? Because it's something, you know, I talk to a lot of younger people, and I always think, you know, I know a lot of older people who, they don't want to talk to young people. And I go, why? Like, they're our future. You know, it's like, I think when we were younger, you know, old people don't want to talk to us. So, I mean, a lot of times people don't want to. And I go, well, no, they're invigorating. They have ideas. You know, they know how to do this shit on TikTok that you go, well, how did you did that video? So how did you, did you plan on finding someone younger? Or, I mean, how did you find Matt?
We weren't planning on it at all. My other younger brother Duncan had taken over from my youngest brother Ali when he left. Duncan took over, and we were very happy doing that. He brought a new life into the band as well. But then he suffered a stroke and decided that he didn't want to do this anymore. So, you know, we were kind of stuck with the idea, but I'd already worked with Matt Doyle on a collaboration album that we did called Bigger Bag of Rhythm when he was lead singer with a band called Kyoko. And we invited the band Kyoko to tour with us for several years. So we knew Matt well. And working in the studio with him on the track that we did, where he sang over our backing track, the song that he'd written, I just knew how good he sounded and how good he fitted in with our sound, you know. And I thought, if Duncan ever decides he doesn't want to do this anymore, this is the kid I'm coming for, you know. Just because he was really impressed me, and I loved the sound of his voice and his style of singing. He'd grown up on UB40, so was a mad fan anyway. He's also related. One of our founder members, Norman, our percussionist, Norman Hassan, he's Matt Doyle's uncle. So, you know, we kept it in the family again. But yeah, as soon as Duncan got ill and couldn't continue, or decided he didn't want to continue, really, then I knew exactly where I was going. And I spoke to the other guys in the band and suggested Matt. And every one of them thought it was a great idea. There were no other candidates. We weren't thinking, should we think of others or try others out? Or there was never any decision, really. It was always going to be Matt Doyle, because he just fitted so great. And and he loves the music, so he was a perfect fit.
Now, how do you introduce, because you do have such a rabid fan base, and they've been fans forever. I mean, as you said, they've been with following you. I mean, I just talked about early 80s, and we gravitated towards your sound. So as the leader of the band, how do you communicate to your fans that, yes, we have a new singer? I mean, it must be odd, because especially now with social media, and you know, everyone bitches about everything now, you know, and they're always, you know, everything up gets people uptight. But how did you introduce him? Like, did you tell people, hey, this guy's great? Or, I mean, how did that go about introducing him to your vast fan base?
Well, I think it was more nerve-wracking for him than it was for us. We already knew how good he was, having worked with him for a few years, you know, and had Kyoko supporting us. They probably did 40 or 50 dates with us in over the previous couple of years, you know. So our fans were also aware of him in the band Kyoko. So it was, I don't know, it wasn't that difficult. As I say, it was probably a lot more stressful for him, being sort of kind of dropped in the deep end, you know. But for us, it was just real easy. And the reaction to him was so good and instant, you know. He was very warmly received by our hardcore fans. And it's always a little bit nerve-wracking, you know. But the reaction was fantastic and has been ever since. I mean, we just recorded last year, we released our first album with Matt, and it gave us a top five album in the UK. So the reaction has been fantastic, you know, and the reception to him has been nothing short of warm and affectionate, you know.
Now, where does the sound come from? I read that your father was a folk singer, and it's just, you know, as I said, you're such a distinct sound. And for us kids and teenagers and 20-year-olds in America, with such so awesome to us. It was different. But how did you get into that sound? Because a lot of times I think people follow in their family's footsteps. I mean, you had a musical influence. It's not like, you know, your father was an accountant and all of a sudden you became a musician. But what was it like growing up in your household when you were younger? What music were you listening to that influenced you to get to where your sound became?
Well, first of all, can I say, I'm not the band's leader. We're very much a democratic outfit. We don't have a leader, never did. The original eight founding members were all of the same mind. We only ever wanted to play one style of music, and that was reggae, because when reggae was invented in the late 60s, we were hearing it. The area that we grew up in was a high immigrant area. A lot of Caribbean, a lot of Jamaican kids a lot of Jamaicans came over to the UK in the 50s. So kids that were born in the 50s and 60s, the first generation of Jamaican-born UK, English-born Jamaicans, we grew up with them. And we were hearing Jamaican pop music when it was ska, and then it turned into reggae. And that was all we ever wanted to be, was a reggae band, much to my father's dismay. Because obviously I was surrounded by music all of my life. From childhood, all I can remember was musicians, you know, playing. I used to sit on the floor when my father's group used to rehearse, his band used to rehearse in the house, and I was surrounded by musicians, you know, and as soon as I showed any interest in any instrument of any kind, it was thrust onto me. And I had guitar lessons from the age of about 10, I think. My uncle taught me, you know, all the basics. So, yeah, I grew up surrounded by music, but the area that I grew up in was key. And it was the music that me and my contemporaries, my friends, three members of the band, the founding members of the band, are of Jamaican parentage. So, you know, that was the music we were hearing and we loved. And as I say, there was never really a discussion about what kind of music. We only ever wanted to be a reggae band. And seeing Bob Marley in our hometown in Birmingham, he played live in 76. We all went to that concert and we all came out going, that's what we got to do. That's what we got to do, you know. We got to stop talking about it and form a band. And it still took probably another 2 years before it got taken seriously by every member of the band. And we all kind of congregated in a cellar under one of the guys' apartments. And yeah, and just sat down and learned to play together, learned to play the music together, you know, learned instruments. And it was, obviously my family was musical, but so the idea of being a musician wasn't odd to me or my family, you know, they were very supportive. Whereas other members of the band, their parents were saying, yeah, but when are you going to get a proper job, you know? it was very much, it was our gang, really, our social gang, our social circle was what became the band and our crew. And we kind of took our social circle on the road with us, you know.
Well, when did you start getting gigs? As you said, you had the idea, it took like 2 years for you to form, and you suddenly said, okay, we really got to get our shit together and do this. When do you start to decide to get gigs? Because, you know, I still perform. I used to do stand-up comedy on the road many years ago. And I remember it went from, you know, that idea in your head. And then you go to an open mic and you do 5 minutes. And then you go, you know what? I got to do 20 minutes to get work. And then it does take time because you have to perfect your craft. That's what people don't understand. It takes time because you don't want to go on and put a bad product. So when did you guys, when you got serious, when did you decide to start to get gigs? And was it easy to get gigs?
It was amazingly easy, really. I guess it was the summer of 78 was when we formed the band and started to play earnestly together. Took a while, but I think about 6 months of playing together and starting to write our own music and things like that, you know, our own lyrics, I guess we had about 6 months or so of playing, and then we got asked to do a private birthday party from some very hip people in the area. You know, they were having a party and they'd all heard about us because we used to play in this cellar, and people used to congregate in the garden of the house and listen to us playing, you know. So we kind of already had a reputation before we even played a show. People were talking about us, you know. So we got asked if we'd play a birthday party, which we did. It was a large birthday party. There were a few hundred people there. And that was our first show. And it went so successfully that we just started to add dates. And we had about a year of gigging around our area, the Midlands, without travelling too far. And then our first trip into London, literally our first time playing in London, Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders was at the show. And she came backstage and said, I love you guys. You've got to come on tour with me. And she had a number one album, a number one single, and a sold out UK tour for the Pretenders, you know. So for her to invite us on that tour was incredible for us. That was just a baptism of fire, you know. We suddenly went from having played maybe 30 shows in our entire career, you know, in the previous year. So it was like a little bit better than a gig every couple of weeks, you know. Then suddenly we're supporting the Pretenders on a sold-out UK tour. And it went so well for us. We released a single while we were on that tour. And when we finished the tour, 6 weeks later, we were number four in the charts in the UK. So, and playing the TV show, you know, Top of the Pops, which was the program that everybody needed to be on, you know.
Millions
were watched every week.
I want to ask you about that, because I always ask about artists, because like in America, for my comedian friends who were older than me, when they got the Tonight Show, the whole career would change. Like I knew a guy who was like living in his car behind the Comedy Store in L.A., and all of a sudden he gets the Tonight Show. He gets signed by William Morris, and like a week later, he's opening for like Julio Iglesias in Vegas. It changed lives. I mean, it just changed. So tell me about your first appearance on Top of the Pops, and was it nerve-wracking, or how did it just, because I know your record has to be at a certain level, but I always love to hear these stories because it fascinates me, because it changes people's lives, and you're in there, just like over in America, the Tonight Show.
I think that's exactly what it was. We were on stage grinning at each other because we couldn't quite believe we were there, you know, but we knew what it meant. We knew the significance of you know, the event, and we kind of felt like, yeah, we've arrived, you know, all of a sudden, in this very short time, a 6 week tour with the Pretenders, we went from relative obscurity, you know, and starting to build a reputation for ourselves, and record companies were talking to us, etc. We went from there to our first record being a top five hit record in the UK. We're playing Top of the Pops, and record companies are queuing up to sign us at that point. So all of a sudden, we felt like we'd arrived. You know, it was a pretty incredible feeling, and I remember every time I looked at any member of the band, all you got was a massive grin, you know, because none of us could believe that we were there.
So when you have these record companies pursuing you, how do you know who to choose? Because, you know, it's not like when you're a musician, you learn the business part of it. You know, it's something that you're young, you want that record deal. You know, you guys, all of a sudden you're thrust in the spotlight and people want you. How did you decide on that first record deal, and were you happy with it?
Well, we were very happy with the first deal we signed was, I have to say that my father's experience as a professional musician played a big part in the way we dealt with record companies, because he'd explained the way record companies worked and how we had to get the best deal for us and not just sign the first deal that came along, you know. And In fact, we turned down most deals because we were kind of full of ourselves. We believed in our worth, and the deals we were being offered were the kind of deals that first time musicians get, you know, which were lousy. And yeah, we just kept refusing and demanding more, and demanding control as well, you know, artistic control, which nobody wanted to give us. They all were saying, you know, we know better than you what you need to be doing, etc. And we really had total confidence in ourselves that we knew what we wanted to do and the sound we wanted to be making, etc., you know. So we just held out until the right guy came along. And he wasn't a big record company. He was an independent who owned a record store and had been putting out records. He'd had a little bit of success with hit singles with a few other artists. And he came to us and offered us a 50-50 deal, simple as that. You know, he offered to pay for the recording of our album and promote it, etc. And it was distributed by an independent wholesaler, and we were the first people to get an album in the charts that was independently distributed, you know, rather than through the majors. So, yeah. It turned out to be the kind of deal we wanted, where we had complete control of what we did. And yeah, he just said, you just give me the record and I'll promote it, you know, I'll sell it and give me whatever record you want, which actually was exactly the same deal we got from Richard Branson, who owned Virgin, and who that was who we moved to a few, you know, a year or so later. And he said exactly the same thing. I will never tell you what you should be doing or, you know, how to do it. You give me the music, you make the music you want and give me the album you want to give me and I'll sell it. And that was all we ever wanted in a deal, really. And yeah, luckily that was what we got.
How amazing as an artist is that when someone comes to you and says, do what you want? Because, you know, you go through that stuff. You know, I wrote a screenplay in L.A. years ago and it never sold, but every meeting, I'm like, no, you don't understand. And you have that argument and you have to deal with this producer. And in the music, yeah, you know, the suits come in and the suits know everything. They never picked up an instrument, but they know everything. How amazing, like, at a young and early in your career, I mean, that must have been one of the most invigorating feelings that they said, hey, guys, just do what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. And it felt like the kind of support that we were after, you know, that we weren't being offered by other record companies. And when we got that, it felt like people have got faith in us. They believe in us as much as we do, you know. And there's nothing more powerful, really, than that. There's no better support than that. To get that from the suits, you know, from the business side of it, where they're saying, we're not going to tell you, we're not ever going to tell you what you've got to record. You just give us the record you want to give us and we'll sell it. And that was the deal that we had, you know.
Now, Labor of Love, that's when we first started hearing you a lot in America. It's covers. Who made that decision? Was that something that, I mean, once again, you had the decision. Was that something that you guys wanted to add? Because it adds a different sound, because you had a different sound. But is that, what was the choice for that album? How did you come up with that idea?
Well, right from the beginning, when we formed the band, that was one of the ideas that we had, was of doing, you know, an album of covers to show people the music that we came from. Because every time we did an interview, people kept saying, "Why are you playing reggae? Why are you guys playing reggae? You know, from Birmingham, half of you are white guys, and you're playing reggae music. What's going on?" You know, and we always had to explain that this was the music we'd grown up on, and you know that it was as much our music as anywhere else. You know, and it was the only music we ever wanted to play, and the idea of the Labour of Love project was to cover those records that we bought in the late 60s and early 70s some of those records that made us fall in love with the music, you know, just to show people where we were coming from. And it was my idea, principally, but everybody loved the idea. Everybody wanted to do it, you know, and it was actually the only negative attitude we got from our record company, because we suggested doing that, and the guy who owned the record company was going, why do you want to do covers? You know, you're known as a political band, you're known for your original lyrics, and why do you want to do an album of old songs, old reggae songs? What do you want to do that for? And he didn't get it. And it was when we moved to Virgin Records with Richard Branson that we said, that was one of the things we said to him. We've had this idea of doing an album of covers now since we started, and we still want to do it. And what do you think about that? And he said, if that's what you want to do, just give me the record and I'll sell it. And he gave us our first number one record with Red Red Wine, of course. So it turned out to be a genius idea, but we had no idea. It was literally just to show people where we were coming from and why we loved the music, you know. Right from the beginning, I'd compiled a list of songs that we would love to cover, but the list was about 200 songs long, you know, literally, because people kept suggesting songs, and it just kept going on the list, you know. And it was when we did the first Labour of Love one, we took a dozen songs from that list, you know, and we did those, and I just hung on to the list and said, when we do the next volume, we'll pick another dozen, you know. And really, that's, I've had that list of songs now for 40 odd years, and I still go back to it. And we still like doing covers, so we still do the odd cover. On the last album, UB45, we did Give Me a Little Sign, which is a soul record from the 60s, you know, which wasn't a reggae record, but it was one of those songs that everybody knew. I discussed that with all the guys, and we said we'd love to do a cover of that, and that was what we did, you know. And we're probably always going to do that because we still have the list.
Right, that's awesome.
I'll go back to it every now and again, you know. It's fun to do.
Now, what was the fascination with Red Red Wine? Because I was just talking to a friend of mine, and I said, yeah, I'm interviewing, you know, Robin from UB40 and Red Red Wine, and he was like, it reminds me of college. And it was just something that it stuck with us. And I don't know, maybe it was because it was a different sound. But in your eyes, as the person who performed it, what do you think was the fascination? Because that song was everywhere in America. You could go to any bar, it didn't make a difference, any club, and they would play it, and the dance floor would get filled. Because that's a bunch of goofy white guys trying to dance a reggae. But it was like, but it was something that we just loved. And it was the 80s, so everyone had fun. But what do you think was the fascination that just made that song blow up? I mean, it was huge.
I've really got no idea. I mean, we had no idea that it was a Neil Diamond song, for starters. You know, really, no idea at all. I knew the song as a record from 68, 69, I think it was. The one I heard was by a guy called Tony Tribe, and he was obviously covering the Neil Diamond record, but I had no idea of the Neil Diamond record. I only knew his because I was in, you know, reggae bars and clubs, and that's the music I was hearing, and I just remember loving that song, and everybody loved that version, you know. And I also heard... There was an R&B version by I think another Jamaican artist, but singing soul music. So I knew that version, and I thought that maybe that was the original version that Tony Tribe was covering. Still had no idea of the Neil Diamond song until we recorded it, sort of, you know, 15 years later when we actually recorded it. And for publishing, it said N Diamond, you know, and we were all going, could that possibly be be Neil Diamond? And then we discovered that, yeah, he'd recorded it in the 60s. And, yeah. But it was spectacularly unsuccessful, Neil Diamond's version. Nobody knew it, you know? So when we did it, we were covering the Tony Tribe version. And it was simply just a tune that we loved. Why it worked, who knows, you know? But the way you talk about it is the way it's treated globally, you know? It's one of those songs that everybody knows, however old they are, you know, that someone might say, oh, my grandma loved that tune, you know? And it just goes down through the generations. When we play shows now, there are teenage kids in the front rows singing Red, Red Wine, you know? So it's one of those songs that works, and who knows why? If you knew why, you'd have a number one every time, wouldn't you?
Exactly. You know? Now, how important do you think MTV was also to the success of that? Because, you know, I try to explain to younger people, you know, before all MTV was... It was all video. Like, we would just watch it. And in college, you'd just watch it. And you'd sit there. I mean, God, when Michael Jackson's Thriller came out, they'd say, airing at 7 o'clock. And you go, oh, my God, it's on. You watched it. I mean, so for you guys, because the video, you know, it's a fun video. And it's you got a bar. And it's the 80s. We all love bars. I mean, that's just the way it is. But how important do you think MTV was to propelling you in America?
How important was MTV full stop, you know? The way pop music was listened to changed with MTV, you know, globally. But, I mean, the success of Red, Red Wine in America was really strange for us because it was kind of 5 years later than everywhere else, because we released that record in 83 and it went number one in 30 countries around the world. But it only got to maybe top 30 in the States. And it wasn't until 5 years later, it got re-released. And I don't really know why, but it got re-released 5 years later because the record company got in touch with us and said, for some reason, this song is kind of really taking off. It's being played, I think it was Arizona. It was a DJ had played it in Arizona and it had got a great reaction over the on the radio, and the next station added it and then the next station added it, and it was suddenly being played by all these radio stations, but it wasn't actually a current single. So the record company got in touch with us and said, can we re-release this song? Because for some reason it's taken off in the States, you know? So 5 years later, weirdly, we suddenly had our first number one record in America, you know? And I really don't know why it happened 5 years later, why it wasn't as successful 5 years earlier. But maybe it was MTV that made the difference. Who knows?
Now, when was your first tour in America? Because I know you're excited to be coming back, and, you know, you come back a lot. But when as a band, when was your first tour in America?
Oh, we've been touring the States from 1980, I think, was the first time. Our first time going to America would have been playing, you know, clubs and bars. And, you know, we toured hard. And we had college radio, you know, was where we had our interest. Even when we weren't having chart success, we were... students, kids were enjoying the music, you know, and it was probably our audience would have been predominantly white, and they knew the music on a sort of cult level, you know, because we weren't having chart success at that time. So we had for years we were coming, and we were having successful gigs. Considering we had no chart success and had no not a lot of radio coverage, we were amazed at the popularity we had, you know, and we kept coming back year after year and playing extensive tours, you know, of where we would be on the bus for several months, you know, traveling around the States and playing In very enjoyable tours and great responses from the audience, but still with no chart success until 88. Was, 8 years later, all of a sudden, Red Red Wine gets re-released and gives us a number one record. And it kind of exploded at that point.
Well, after Labor of Love, because it was successful, did you guys want to, in your mind, you had so much fun doing the covers, and you had one doing, you had your list. The next album, did it ever cross your mind, maybe we should just do another cover album, or do you guys have, as a creative type, sit there and go, we want to do our own music? Because a lot of times people, they want to, when you have success, you want to dip into it again, because it's something that, we don't know, no one knows how long success is ever going to last. So after Labor Love, what was the band's consensus? Did you want to do originals again? Because it's something that people were probably wondering what was going on.
Yeah, we've always enjoyed doing our own original music, but obviously the success of Labor of Love globally was encouraging. And of course, the record company would be saying to us, when are you going to give us another Labor of Love,
Right.
And we were kind of holding off on that for years. And we were saying, we're not ready yet. It's not time yet, And here's another album of original material with the occasional covers, because we've always enjoyed doing covers. We did I Got You Babe with Chrissy, and that went number one in the UK and several other countries as well, So again, that was a cover, and it was, very successful for us. People were all saying to us, when are you going to do a Labour of Love 2? And really, I think the success of Red Red Wine in America 5 years later was kind of the catalyst for us doing volume 2 of Labour of Love. And when we did release it in, 89 or 90, I think, maybe a year or two after the success of Red Red Wine in America, we released the second volume, and then we had maybe 3 or 4 top 10 hits in the States off that album. So, it's always been calling us. It's always been, let's do another Labour of Love, But we like to leave it a while, because it's not all we do, and we don't want to be known as a covers band. And we do original albums, and out of the 20-odd albums we've done 4 Labour of Loves. The other 17 or 18, whatever it is, are, principally original material.
Now, when it comes to original material, and when you have a big group, a big band, what is your writing process? Because, is it just a few of you? Is it everyone's, it's a think tank? Do you sit around a table? Because it always fascinates me, because when you look up the songs, it says all by UB40. So there's not the single, written by Robin, written by this, So what has your writing process been throughout the years? And has it changed as you've gotten older?
No, it's still pretty much the same. But right from the get-go, we've always agreed, because we're a democratic outfit, because we don't have a leader, we do everything together, we vote on everything. It's a very long-winded process. Doing anything through UB40 is a very long-winded process. But we always agreed that whatever happened, we would share everything equally. So all 8 members were equal beneficiaries of the writing process, Even though there are 3 members of the band who were the principal songwriters, myself, Jimmy Brown, our drummer, and Brian Travers, who's passed away now, was probably our most prolific lyricist over the years. But every member has contributed at some point. Everybody's contributed a song, except maybe Mickey, our original keyboard player. I don't think he ever wrote anything, but the music is very definitely a collaborative thing. We've always none of us reads or writes music, so we've always just jammed in the studio and just kept playing things until we get something we like. And that's not difficult, you know, music just comes out of us easily, and that's what we enjoy doing. So we sit in a studio and we jam together until we've got something we like, and we go record that, you know. And every time we make an album, we've probably got 20 different bits of instrumentation, you know, instrumental tunes, backing tracks. And then various members of the band will bring lyrics in and say, I've got this idea, I've got this, you know. And sometimes we collaborate and rewrite or add more, or, you know, somebody will come up with a chorus for somebody else's song or whatever, you know. But generally, the three of us would bring in lyrics, and, you know, we would just then sit down and put them to one of the tunes. Sometimes you'd have an idea for a lyric already with an existing piece of music that we've been playing for a while, you know, in the studio. And that was, I mean, literally, it's a very kind of collaborative, very slow process where we just keep jamming together and pitching in ideas until we get something that we all like, you know, and something that works for us. And it's always been that way and still is that way, really. You know, we still always are short of lyrics, always got much too much music and not enough lyrics. You know, lyrics is the hardest part of it. And, you know, we're always badgering each other to come up with another song, you know, and that's literally how we do it.
So you have all this music, you're playing all these years, and I want to just talk about when your brother left. And it's like, you know, you think you guys are probably such a well-oiled machine because you've been in a studio doing all those albums. I mean, I'm sure there's always going to be disagreements with bands. You know, that happens. You know, sometimes people get too big too fast. But what is that like when you lose a family member? Like when Ali left, what was it? I know I've read where it's like he wanted to make more money, but you guys were happy. You guys are, as I talk to you, you're a true artist. You love music. You're the same guys mentally that you were when you picked up those instruments and were listening to that reggae going, we can do this. We, you know, and it's like, you know, it's like I talk to people a lot. You know, I talk to actors who, you know, they're character actors. They got their ups and downs. You know, they'll be on a TV series, then they won't work for 2 years. And they're like, thank God we put that money away. But my one friend said, you know, I don't know how to do anything else. He goes, you know, this is what I do. You know, I'd rather be performing in front of one person instead of working at like a restaurant, you know? So for you, what is it? I mean, he left because he was tired of making the music, or what happened? And what is that for you as the big brother who is like it's your family?
Yeah, it was traumatic, you know. But can I just say, there seems to be this ongoing story of how a feud developed between us two, and, you know, the rift is in between the brothers, you know. That's just not true. He didn't fall out with me. He left the band. He walked away from the band. All of whom considered themselves to be his brother, because we've all grown up together. I've known everybody in the band since they were 10 years old. Some of them even less, you know, even younger. And we all know each other very well, all considered ourselves a band of brothers, you know. And we all knew how lucky we were, how for us to have been as successful as we were without any musical training or anything, you know, to be lucky enough that together we make a sound that has become as popular as it is, you know, and as successful as it has been all this time. We just always celebrated that, and always, it's always a kind of pinch me moment, you know, when you realise how successful you are, you know, and when the success continues over and over again for decades, you know. So yeah, we always celebrated that and always enjoyed that and loved that about the band and our relationship. You know, Ali got to a point where he just didn't want to be in the band anymore. He wanted to do his own thing. He wanted to go off and make his own music. He thought he knew better than all of us how to make music. You know, he thought he was the talent, I guess. You know, it was weird because he kind of grew distant from the band over the years. I knew he was going to go, and I was telling other members of the band that he was going to go, and they would go, "No, he'll never leave. You know, he's Ali. Don't be ridiculous. He'll never leave." And I was going, "He's my kid brother. I know him, and I know he's leaving. So prepare yourselves because he's going to leave." Because he just had other ideas, you know. He just wanted to do something else. And there was no great rift in the band. There was no big divide. There was no big fallout. He just said one day, "I've been offered a tour," because he was making his own solo albums. He'd done a couple. And we'd actually delayed the release of our album for about 6 months so that he could promote his solo album. And while he was promoting the album, he came to us and said, "I've just been offered a UK tour and I want to do it." And we said, "Well, we've delayed our release and it's now going to happen. And we've got tours and dates and you can't go off and do your own thing because we have a tour now. You know, we gave you 6 months. You've taken that 6 months. Now we're on the road starting next week." And he said, "Well, I'm leaving the band then." It was that simple, you know. He just said, "I'm leaving." And in fact, he couldn't leave that quickly because the promoter, we were about to go to Australia to do an Australian tour and New Zealand. And the promoter of that tour said, "If you leave, I'll sue you because you've got this tour that is booked and sold. It's sold out and you can't leave, you know." So he said, "Okay, I'll do that tour, then I'm leaving." And that was what happened. He just left, you know. And it was very difficult. But you have to learn to deal with these
right.
things.
I was gonna say you have to deal with it because you have to think, so how long did it take you to sit there and go, "Okay, here's what we're gonna do"? Because it's like you knew, and because you, of course, you're the big brother and intuition and stuff like that. And the other guys didn't know, so all of a sudden, even though you've warned them, no one wants. It's like when people go, "There's a hurricane coming," and people don't leave their house in Florida. And the next thing you know, you see the guy on top of a trailer in water.
Absolutely, yeah. So, guys just didn't want to believe it. You know, they just didn't want to believe it that he could possibly leave because a few years before that it would have been impossible. He would never have left. You know, because he was as much a part of the band as anybody else at that point. You know, he would never have considered leaving, but he just grew more distant over the last few years, and he got to a point where he wanted to do his own thing. You know, and we just had to. There was never a question of us all just giving up. Right. You know, we just, okay, he's leaving. How do we deal with it? And again, I suggested to the guys that my other younger brother would happily fill Ali's place. And I mean, we'd always sung together as kids, you know, the three brothers had always harmonized and sung together. So everyone knew Duncan could sing. Everyone knew that, you know, that he'd regretted that he didn't join the band in the first place, you know, all those years ago. And he'd kind of harbored a desire to be a singer, you know, for 30 years. And, I literally went, as soon as I knew Ali was leaving, as soon as Ali had said, "I'm leaving the band," I then went to my other younger brother and said, "Do you want the gig?" You know, which blew him away, you know. And he said, "Well, I won't do it unless I get Ali's blessing. because, and I said, yeah, but he's gone. He's left.
He, you know. He left. He left. It's not like, it's not like you're taking his job. He left.
Exactly. You're not taking his job. You're taking, you're filling a space, you know? And he spoke to Ali and said, I won't take the job if you don't, you know, and Ali said, it's got nothing to do with me. I've left. You do what you want, you know, and then never spoke to him again.
That's insane. Now, I want to ask you this, because I always love people, you know, as I said, Red Red Wine was big in the 80s. The 80s were such a special time, and I, you know, I have a lot of friends, we just remember the 80s. What do you think, as a performer who was living it and seeing the whole scene, what do you think made the 80s so damn special that people still come out and, like you said, you know, grandparents and kids and grandkids, you'll see probably it's like a 5-year-old with a UB40 t-shirt. What do you think made the 80s so damn special? Because it was the music. I get all different, Jack Hughes and Wang Chung is one answer. Paul Young gave me another answer. To you, what made the 80s so special?
Paul Young, what a lovely man. I have no idea. I really have no idea. It's a bit difficult for me to answer that because I still think the 60s was the greatest musical decade of all time. You know, you didn't just have the Beatles and you didn't just have Tamla Motown and, you know, American R&B and the whole British pop sound, you know, which included spearheaded by the Beatles, but you also had people like the Rolling Stones and many, many other bands, you know, and that changed pop music. But you also had, from my point of view, reggae was invented in the 60s, you know, and for me, there was no better decade, no more influential decade than the 60s musically and globally, you know. So when the 80s happened and everyone was talking about what an incredible decade it was for music, I was kind of nonplussed, really. I was, what do you mean? The 60s is the decade, you know? And I felt like the 70s was even though there's some great music from the 70s, you know, people like Stevie Wonder, you know, who I consider to be one of the 20th century musical geniuses, he, you know, he ruled the 70s as far as I was concerned, but there was lots of other kinds of music. And I think really it depends what age you are. And, you know, everybody's best decade is their teen decade, I guess, you know, because that's the year you form your musical taste, your musical allegiances, you know, and that you never lose them. I still now, my jukebox has 60s and 70s records on it, you know. It still has those records. I don't put new records on my old jukebox, you know. It's but that doesn't mean there isn't good music happening. Of course there is, all the time. But yeah, the 80s was it was a great musical decade when you look back at it, you know. There's so many artists, but for me, I couldn't answer what makes it special, because for me, the 60s was the decade that changed the world.
Now, you have the tour, as we say, coming up in America. And as you say, we said you have so many albums. How do you put a playlist together? Because I know you have to put in certain songs. But, you know, you have so many songs, and there's probably ones that you just love and you just want to put on. And you know, you get the different, you get, like, when you've been around as long as you guys have, you get a whole different fan base. You know, it's different ages. So some people may know your early stuff. Some people all of a sudden found you a little later. So, and you can't please everybody. So, like, if you're upcoming an American tour, of course, there's a few you have to play, because else people go, they didn't play that. But how do you put a guest, how do you put a set list together when you have such a huge, vast collection of tunes?
Well, you just totally summed up my dilemma. It's the problem we have every time we put a tour together. There are certain songs you have to play, so you always play those songs. You know, songs like Red Red Wine and Can't Help Falling in Love are always going to be in the set. They have to be. because those are the tunes that turns people onto you in the first place, you know. Even if they love other songs more now, you must play those songs, you know. And there are certain songs, certain other songs, like Kingston Town and Cherry O' Baby, that we always play, because if you don't, people are going to go, you didn't play my favourite, you know. So there are half a dozen songs you must play, and then there are half a dozen tunes that you want to play off your new album, and then the rest is pick and choose, you know. You resurrect old tunes that you know were favourites in the old days, and you bring them back for an airing to see how they're responded to. And you just try and, you literally just try and keep a mix. Sometimes it depends on the territory you're in, because we've had number ones all over the world, and sometimes songs are number ones in some countries and only top 10 in another country, you know, and you forget about those songs, but then you get to somewhere like Holland and they go, you've got to do Sing Our Own Song, because that was a number one here, remember that, you know. So it changes very slightly depending on the territory you're playing, but on the whole, when we tour, we play a few songs off the new album, and we play the ones we must play, and the rest is us having fun, you know. We dig up old tunes that we haven't done for a while, and we play favourites, you know, and then we play favourites of ours, a couple of favourites of ours that we love playing that, you know, maybe not so that more hardcore fans would love, you know. And it's pretty much like that all the time, but you can't forget what keeps you popular, what keeps the fans coming back, and those are those songs that you have to play, you know. So I mean, it really annoys me if I go and see an artist and they don't play any of their hits, you know, right, because they're bored with them. And I kind of, how dare you, you know? What gave you the success that you've got now? This audience that have come to see you are coming because of the songs that you're refusing to play, you know? And that just isn't good enough as far as I'm concerned. You've got to keep the audience happy. It's a thankless task, and it's nigh on impossible, because someone will always come to you after the show and say, you didn't play my favorite.
Yeah, you're like, we have over 20 albums. Anyway, I have one final question for you. You know, you've had this long, very successful career. You know, you've toured the world, done more than most people could ever dream of, you know, and you did it sticking to your art and sticking to your guns and being, when you look back in your life, what are a few things that make you really, really proud?
Well, literally that we've stuck to our guns, you know, and we've kept the ethos of the band the same. We still share everything equally. We always have done, always will do. You know, there are still four original members of the band, and, you know, but there are, 11 of us on stage. So, you know, we've got seven guys that we've gathered over the last, I mean, the horn section that's with us now, they've been with us for 30 years. So they're members of the band, you know. But we're gathering new members. And that for me is the greatest joy, is that people like Matt Doyle, our lead vocalist, and Jared from Jamaica, and my son, Matt Campbell, who is on stage doing backing vocals and on record now doing backing vocals. The fact that we can keep this whole machine going, you know, that maybe there'll still be a UB40 playing when there's none of the original founder members left, you know. But I love that idea. The idea that the brand UB40 still playing the same music, you know, with the same ethos and the same politics, etc. You know, that for me is wonderful. And that's what we've kept alive, you know, even though we've lost several members, passed on, you know, and a couple have left of their own accord. But, you know, we still keep the whole thing going. We keep the fires burning, and we're still full of the same enthusiasm that we had 40 odd years ago, you know. And that, to me, that is our greatest success.
Well, that is awesome. I'm so thankful you came on tonight, Robin. People, go to UB40.global, and I'll go buy UB45. They had an anthem from the Birmingham Commonwealth Games. And go see them in tour. They're touring in America. The tour starts in August, I believe. August in America? Yeah. So go check them out. They're a great band. And just, you'll love it. Just go, after you listen to this show, go drink a glass of red wine for us. Also, you can go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 1,040 episodes there. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. So anyway, go check out UB40. Go check out past episodes of my show. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.